I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, tracking the ocean's flotsam and jetsam. And what's the difference between the two anyway? But first, in Iraq today, hundreds of Iraqis protested a 3-mile-long, 12-foot-high wall that the U.S. military is building in one neighborhood to protect some Iraqis and corral others. The Iraqi prime minister ordered a halt to the construction yesterday, but not everyone seems to be on the same page. Here's Ryan Crocker, the new U.S. ambassador in Iraq.
We will respect the wishes of the government and the prime minister. I'm not sure just where we are right now concerning our discussions on how to move forward on this particular issue.
Well, joining us from Baghdad is Tina Sussman, Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Tina, we understand this is one of many walls in Baghdad. Describe them for us. Why are they being put up?
Well, the walls differ in their appearance. Some are higher than others. One of the things that a military spokesman explained to us today is that the height of the wall depends on the threat. For instance, if an area is known for car bombs, then the wall doesn't need to be as high. But if an area is known for mortar attacks and some more spectacular attacks, then they want to build the wall a lot higher.
Well, the one that's being protested, what is the reason for building it? I know it's not completed yet. And, yeah. And what does it look like?
The one that's being built now in the area of Adamiya, it's being constructed because Adamiya has got an unusual geographical location. It is a Sunni-dominated neighborhood. It is considered one of the real hot spots of Baghdad. It's considered a no-go area by Shiites and even by a lot of Sunnis. It's really considered a hotbed of insurgents in there. And it is surrounded, basically, by Shiite neighborhoods. So the thinking, apparently, behind this wall was that it would make it much easier to prevent the insurgents who are conducting attacks from inside Adamiya on neighboring neighborhoods to do this. It also makes it more difficult for any Shiite to get into Adamiya. And in terms of what it looks like, it's not one giant piece of concrete. It's not a wall as most people probably imagine a wall to look like. Essentially what it is a series of massive concrete slabs, each weighing about 14,000 pounds. And these are brought in by the military, generally under cover of darkness at night. And then they're put up piece by piece, which is why it's going to take about a month to finish this wall.
Well, and what can you tell us today? Because it's a little confusing from Ambassador Crocker's statement. Is the U.S. military going to stop building the wall as the Iraqi government has requested?
This is a very good question. It even got more confusing after Ambassador Crocker made his statements because this was followed by a news briefing from both U.S. and Iraqi military officials, both of whom make clear that they consider walls such as this a logical solution, at least a temporary solution, to some of the problems going on here. The Iraqi official, Brigadier General Qasim Moussaoui, he said flat out, no, construction is not going to stop. He also insisted that this is not really a wall. He said it's a barrier, and the difference, he said, is that it's temporary. The U.S. military spokesman kind of left open the idea of whether construction would go on, but he also made clear that temporary solutions, he emphasized that it's temporary, such as this, are just one of the many solutions that they feel are necessary to get violence under control.
In fact, the U.S. military said last week that the wall was one of the centerpieces of a new strategy, but in a separate statement, a military spokesperson said the U.S. military does not have a new strategy of building walls in gated communities. It sounds like the word temporary is key there. You were going to say there's a big question unanswered. What's that?
Well, I guess the big question unanswered is what's the Iraqi government going to do or say next? Because obviously the feeling is that Prime Minister Maliki's statement, which came across quite late last night, Baghdad time, came as quite a surprise to the military. He said it at a news conference in Cairo, but I think what happened was that news of the wall came out in a U.S. military press release, and this was last week. Local residents began expressing their dismay with it once they were contacted by the press to get their opinions, and it just caught fire. And then today you have military, both the U.S. and Iraqi, is saying, well, you know, it's not really a wall. So if you look at it, I think most people would consider it a wall. I mean, maybe if you have a large crane capable of picking up 14,000 pounds of concrete, it's temporary. But the point is, to the people living on either side of it, it doesn't seem temporary at all. To them, they say it's just another reminder of, you know, this further, what some have even called Balkanization of Baghdad.
And by the way, Tina, before we let you go, just to be clear, will people not be able to pass the wall? Will there be checkpoints where, you know, at a certain point along the wall they can pass? Or is it really corralling people inside and outside of the wall?
You will not be able to cross the wall in a vehicle. From what I have seen of it, you could cross it on foot if you're able to squeeze between the concrete slabs.
Tina Sussman, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, on this day after Earth Day, we're taking a close look at the state of the world's oceans, and it's not pretty.
What is it?
An old balloon wrapper.
Hey, look, there's another piece of trash.
Oh, you're right.
There's another piece of trash.
Let's go see. Where?
There.
What is it?
It's an old plastic baggie.
Another bag.
Like a lunch bag or something.
Here now, producer Lynn Menegon with her nephews at the beach in Connecticut recently. In all probability, no matter how much you think you know about ocean trash, there's more to learn in a new book for young people called Tracking Trash, Flotsam, Jetsam, and the Science of Ocean Motion. For instance, did you know that there is a floating patch of garbage somewhere in the Pacific between Hawaii and California so big it takes a week for a ship to cut through? It's called the Eastern Garbage Patch, an estimated 3 million ton disgusting garbage hairball the size of Alaska, thick with shampoo caps, water bottles, plastic bags, fishing nets. Well, Dr. Lori Griffin Burns is the author of Tracking Trash, and she joins us. Welcome.
Thank you.
I laugh when I say it's for young people because I read it, you know, like, oh, really? You're kidding. For me, it was informative. Your first book, I know you studied biochemistry. What was your interest in trash in the ocean?
I read an article in the Worcester Telegram and Gazette probably the spring of 2003.
Here in Massachusetts.
And it was right around the time that scientists were predicting that one of these famous lost cargo shipments was going to start washing ashore on the eastern coast.
Now, we have to explain to people, this is the huge cargo containers that are the size of 18-wheelers without the wheels that get knocked off cargo ships.
That's right.
The cargo itself was going to be washed?
Yes, this was a spill. It was 30,000 or so rubber bathtub toys that had fallen off of a cargo ship in the Pacific Ocean in 1991. And here we were in 2003, and these little floating duckies were supposed to start washing ashore on the New England coast, and I just found that astounding and interesting.
How did they get there? Well, one of the people that you find to help you answer that question is Dr. Kurt Ebbesmeyer. He became an Uber beachcomber in the 90s when hundreds of sneakers showed up on the beaches in Seattle, and his mother said to him, "You're a researcher. Find out where these sneakers came from." And the answer was
also a cargo spill. And so he talked to beachcombers, realized that all of the sneakers that were washing up were the same brand. And he called the manufacturer, which happened to be Nike, and eventually got in touch with folks in the transportation department that were able to tell him, yes, we lost a giant shipment of sneakers. And the really exciting part for him came when they told him exactly where the shipment had fallen into the ocean. And that's when the flags went off for him as an oceanographer, because he realized if he knew exactly where these sneakers fell into the ocean and started to learn from beachcombers where they washed up, he might really start to be able to learn something about ocean currents.
Not just ocean currents. And through your book, we learn about currents and waves and longitude and latitude. By the way, I'd forgotten that longitude and latitude is also parallels and meridians.
That's right.
But about plastics. Mm-hmm. And as you discover, he's also tracking those 28,000 plastic tub toys, which ironies abound. I mean, these are the little, you know, ducks and turtles and, you know, primary colored little plastic toys that, you know, you put in the bathtubs, now floating around the big bathtub of the ocean. First of all, we sort of know the answer, but why so important to know where sneakers float to or how long plastic toys last in the ocean before they wash up in Massachusetts?
Well, for the first part of your question, why is it important to know where they go? It's understanding how the patterns of ocean currents in the ocean change from season to season and from year to year. And that information is helpful not only for finding where these cargo ships end up, but probably more importantly for things like mammal migration, sea mammal migrations, fish populations, things like that. It helps oceanographers and other ocean scientists to understand the patterns of movement in the ocean.
In fact, Dr. Ebersmeyer works with people, for instance, who are trying to contain oil spills.
That's right.
And that it helps in that
That's
as
right.
well.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And the plastic part. What he's discovering with now hundreds of beachcombers that he's organized, along with another scientist, James Ingraham, who uses computer software, they formed the Beachcombers and Oceanographers International Association, people around the world recovering this container debris. What are they currently tracking?
They're still tracking, believe it or not, the sneakers, the tub toys that we've talked about. There was another sneaker spill. In fact, there have been several sneaker spills. Computer monitors in a recent issue of his newsletter, I read about tin cans of water chestnuts. So there's these spills are really fairly common.
34,000 hockey gloves, 1,000
yes.
fur logs, 4 million Lego pieces
yes.
are bobbing out there with these little toys. And, you know, it sort of becomes this, gee, that's fun tracking little rubber duckies around the world until, you know, we look at some of the pictures in your book and there is, a monk seal strangled by a fishing net, or there's a photograph of, is it a fish or a bird that's cut open? And
it's a bird.
Yeah,
it's
tell us about that.
That's a photograph that someone showed to me when I was at one of the beachcomber fairs that Kurt attends to talk to beachcombers and hear about things that are washing up. And it was shown to me by a woman who had found the northern fulmar, I think. She'd found the bird and she snapped that photograph because in its carcass you could see just a ton of plastic. It was almost unbelievable how
yeah.
much plastic was there. And she had not only taken the photograph, she collected with tweezers each and every piece of plastic that she found there. So in the book you'll see the photograph of the bird with the plastic inside the carcass, but then also beside it, a picture of all the plastic that she pulled out.
Right.
And it really, for me, it's just such a strike. It's a sad image, but it's so striking. It's clear that that's most likely how this bird died. With that much plastic in its stomach, it's hard to imagine that it could have survived.
And the plastic, again, these vibrant, you know, bright colors, because nothing about the plastic diminishes. I mean, it doesn't, what's the word I'm looking for? It doesn't break down at all.
It doesn't. It does mechanically degrade a little bit into smaller and smaller pieces of plastic. And in fact, sometimes the colors do change, but the plastic itself never goes away. It's just smaller and smaller bits and pieces.
That's Dr. Lori Griffin Burns, author of the new book, Tracking Trash, Flotsam, Jetsam, and the Science of Ocean Motion. She'll be back with us in a moment to talk about something called the Eastern Garbage Patch. This is off the coast of California. It's a huge floating collection of plastic bags, bottles, hard hats, those awful fishing nets, maybe missing socks from your dryer might be there. You know, it's just an amazing sight. And she'll also tell us maybe what we can do to help track this trash and stop this. Also later in the show, longtime Russian watcher Marshall Goldman on the late now Boris Yeltsin. Back after a quick break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Dr. Lori Griffin Burns, author of the terrific new book, Tracking Trash, Flotsam, Jetsam, and the Science of Ocean Motion. And Lori, you've told us a little bit about how scientists keep track of trash found on beaches. You also write about scientists Dr. Kurt Ebersmeyer and Charlie Moore, who sail to the Eastern Garbage Patch. Now, this is this huge mass of flotsam and jetsam floating between the coasts of California and Hawaii. What did Ebersmeyer find?
Everything. I mean, there's some natural debris, of course. There'll be logs and driftwood, things like that. But there's lots of net debris. Plastic bags are a big thing. He talks about bottle caps. Hard hats are a big thing you'll see. I mean, it's incredible how much stuff is out there. And it collects in this area, of course, because of the way the currents swirl. And this is an area that a number of different currents moving in different directions sort of coalesce and come together.
A gyre?
A gyre, it's called. This is the edge of one of those gyres where a number of currents are coming together. And the currents themselves come together, and there's something called downwelling where the water moves down to feed the currents at the bottom of the ocean. But the junk that comes in on these currents isn't able to sink. And so it just sort of floats around in the top there. And It's not pretty.
I love when Dr. Ebersmeyer was asked by someone, why can't we just go break it down bit by bit? And his response was?
That it would be like trying to mow the state of Texas twice. It's just, it would be really hard to go out there and pick up each and every piece. What I really hoped for the book was a photograph of the garbage patch, because we talk about it and you hear people talk about it in books like mine or in news media, but I've never actually seen it. And what Charlie tells me is that it's very hard to see the trash. It's not as if you stand on the boat and you look out and you see just a garbage patch. A lot of the things are floating in, at different ways, some on the top, some slightly below the surface, some even deeper. And so you have to be able to stand up and actually look over the side in order to see it.
Well, and the other thing that you can see and can be a hazard is a ghost net. What's
right.
a ghost net?
A ghost net is a net that either fell off of a fishing vessel or was torn from a fishing vessel or in some cases thrown off a fishing vessel. And what happens to these nets is they get all tangled up in the currents as they're floating. Other debris, whether it's plastic pieces or other net debris or logs, whatever, get all tangled up, and these nets continue to float around. They're very buoyant, and unfortunately they can snag fish and marine mammals.
Turtles, and kill them.
Right.
Ghost nets also destroy coral. I'm reading a section where someone says it's like a bulldozer
yes.
hit it. Why?
Yes.
Because they roll over it?
Well, they're buoyant for a certain amount of time, but as you might imagine, as more and more junk and debris gets rolled up in these nets, they may sink. And if they sink over a coral reef, the tides are still brushing this giant net mass back and forth over the coral. And it is just like a bulldozer. It's just crushing the coral.
Well, we know people are trying to pull the huge ghost nets out, some of them as big as school buses. But what else can people do? I mean, as we said, you're not going to be able to pull apart that big garbage patch. But given that only 20% of the garbage in that garbage patch comes from containers, 80% comes from land-based rivers and storm drains.
Right.
What can we do?
Well, the first thing we can do, of course, is make sure your trash goes where it's supposed to go and doesn't get left behind on the beach. The other thing that...
Which it sounds like not even on the beach. It sounds like anywhere, inland, in
yes.
a river, anywhere. It's
yes.
going to wash in.
Absolutely,
right.
absolutely. And so whenever you can, of course, you want trash to go in the proper receptacle. The other thing is there's a lot of activity these days for cleaning up beaches. And these activities, as far as Kurt Ebersmeyer and Charlie Moore are concerned, are very effective. Events are organized where people can come and clean up the beach. You're given the tools to do that, usually a plastic bag and gloves, and you're asked to pick up everything you find on the beach in a certain area. But also, you're asked to record everything that you find.
Why is that?
The hope is that if we can keep track of how much we're finding, the sheer amount of debris that we're finding will make a difference. It will have an impact. It will help these environmental groups to convince lawmakers to change policies. For example, there are laws now in some parts of the country, I think in California, where smoking outside on the beaches is now prohibited. And this comes from just the huge numbers of cigarette butts that people doing these beach cleaning operations were finding.
You give a lot of information. Again, this is for young people, but I highly recommend it for anyone who's sort of thinking, now what again is a parallel, and how does plankton work? But as you say, you can do it on your own, certainly, but it's better to register.
Absolutely. Those sheets, all that information will be tabulated and gotten into the hands of people who can use that information to save the oceans, really.
Dr. Lori Griffin Burns is the author of the new book, Tracking Trash, Flotsam, Jetsam, and the Science of Ocean Motion. Last question. You have a glossary in the back. So there is a difference between flotsam and jetsam.
There is.
What are they?
So flotsam is something that falls into the ocean, and jetsam refers to something that has been intentionally thrown into the ocean.
See? So flotsam could be like a ship found floating on the sea, and jetsam is, something that, you know, you throw into the ocean. What would it be? A frisbee that
sure.
you don't recover.
Yes,
yeah.
yes.
There you go. Well, again, the book Flotsam, Jetsam, The Science of Ocean Motion. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And a quick note, environmental issues were the talk of this weekend's White House Correspondents' Dinner. Environmental activist Lori David and performer Sheryl Crow apparently approached White House advisor Karl Rove at the dinner, they said, to talk about global warming. Well, it didn't go well. David and Crow write in their blog that as Crow touched his arm, Rove fumed, "Don't touch me." Rove told the Associated Press that the pair had insulted him. Well, that might have been the only spark of the evening. Remember last year when Stephen Colbert's scathing humor seemed to wound the press corps?
Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction.
Well, if organizers wanted tamer fare this year, they apparently got it. Rich Little. He last headlined the event in 1984, and this weekend revived his impersonations of Johnny Carson, Andy Rooney, and Ronald Reagan.
They said, "Mr. President, do you think the war on poverty is over?" And I said, "Yes, and the poor lost."
The Washington Post reports that people bolted for the exit after Little's performance. Or as actor Harry Shearer put it, he got a walking ovation. Well, still to come today, the legacy of the late Boris Yeltsin. His death was announced by the Kremlin earlier today. Back after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Former Russian President Boris Yeltsin, who engineered the final collapse of the Soviet Union and pushed Russia to embrace democracy and a market economy, died today. The Interfax news agency says Yeltsin died of heart failure at 76. His death comes as critics of his successor, Vladimir Putin, say the reforms Yeltsin instituted are being chipped away. Marshall Goldman is senior scholar at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. He joins us now to place Boris Yeltsin's life in context. And Marshall, Boris Yeltsin's death reminds us he wore so many hats before he stepped down as president because of ill health in 1999. He was a communist boss, then a maverick who challenged his predecessor, Mikhail Gorbachev, for being too slow to reform. But he also helped to prevent the coup against Gorbachev in 1991. Do I understand you were there?
I was. I arrived the day after the coup began, but was there when Yeltsin stood on the tank, when Yeltsin spoke in the Supreme Soviet, the Russian Supreme Soviet, and Gorbachev came along, and Yeltsin humiliated Gorbachev in the process. It was a very exciting and a very interesting time. But he did really bring down, he brought down the Soviet Union. He brought about the collapse.
Right. He quit the Communist Party and he pushed for reforms, as we said. But just go back and just hear a little more about all those different moments you mentioned. Who was that figure on top of a tank who was able to stop a coup against Gorbachev, whom he also criticized?
Yes. Well, what happened is that Yeltsin had decided in his attempt to humiliate Gorbachev in revenge for the fact that Gorbachev had humiliated Yeltsin. Then Yeltsin decided he would run for the president of the Russian Republic, which was one of the 15 republics in the country. But he was the first Russian ever to do that. So he had legitimacy. He had legitimacy because he faced up and he ran and got this popular vote. So that allowed him then to challenge the hardliners, the conservatives, the people from the KGB and the military who were conducting this coup. And people rallied around Yeltsin in a spectacular way. And he then, in a sense, brought in the whiff of democracy in a way much more than Gorbachev had, and then led to the bringing in the market, bringing in freedom of the press, all the different kinds of things that we came to associate with that very happy period in Russia.
Well, then what happened? Because as you said, he does get this credit for hastening or for causing the collapse of the Soviet Union, pushing reforms. But what about at home?
What happened at home, of course, is that his health was bad. He was an alcoholic. He would disappear for long periods of time. And he gave away too much. The process of transition to privatization was not well thought out, and it led to a few people stealing large quantities of assets that made them a billionaire, so that you ended up with more billionaires in Moscow than you had in New York City.
This was also a huge criticism of Yeltsin because he was supposed to be the reformer.
That's right. Well, he reformed, but it was the wrong kind of reforms, and they went too far. So there, economically, there were serious problems. There were also serious problems politically because some of the parts of the country began to say, we want secession. What happened under Yeltsin's watch, the economy shrunk by 40%. There was a Great Depression. And he was blamed for that. And his legacy will be that he ended Russia as a superpower. And that's what makes Putin so popular, and that others are coming along and saying Putin will restore that glamour and that glory that was Russia.
Tell us more about how we would view today's Russia with all of this in mind. Are we seeing Putin determinedly reversing what Yeltsin tried to institute? Is Putin saying, as he nationalizes, for instance, industries like oil, is he saying Yeltsin was wrong?
He's very much saying that Yeltsin is wrong, so that when Putin took over, private companies, the state was producing about 15% of the country's oil. Now the state is now producing about 50% of the country's oil. So Putin is gradually unraveling those reforms, the privatization. He's unraveled the reforms about freedom of the press. The state now controls all the major TV networks. There are still a few radio stations and newspapers that are independent, but it is all collapsing very quickly, and in part as a reaction against the fact that Yeltsin went too far.
How should he have done it, by the way, according to analysts like yourself? What you know, applauded for pushing reforms, pushing democracy, pushing the free market, but what should he have done?
Well, what I think he should have done it, but he should have done it in a different way and gone much more slowly. And not allowed just a very few people to grab hold. The Poles, for example, in Poland, had privatization, which went much more successfully without a few very rich people ending up. It would have been hard under any circumstances, but Yeltsin has to be criticized for the fact that it went in the wrong direction too quickly.
Well, and another terrible, terrible stumbling block for Yeltsin was that as the regions revolted against his reforms, one of them was Chechnya. And he is the one who sent Russian troops to fight the rebels in Chechnya.
Right. Well, this was part. At some point, Yeltsin said, okay, there's just too much secession. The country is really unraveling. And this is what he attempted to do to prevent it. So Chechnya was really the first effort to try to hold the country together. And it's a legacy, again, that will haunt him.
Yeah. You know, I can hear your phone ringing, Marshall Goldman, in the back. Place this, you know, people like yourself who watch Russia with such interest. What, you know, his passing, he obviously was not in power, hadn't been for years, had been in ill health, possibly, as you said, an alcoholic. But what does his passing do something? Does something get unhinged? Does something happen as he passes?
Well, I think what it's for the Russian people, I don't think they'll miss him. Because the swing now towards Putin and a very different set of values, a very different set of concerns, suggests that Yeltsin was important for undoing the Soviet Union, but in the process, the pendulum swung too far, and what we have to worry about is that it'll go too far in the other direction now to try to correct what the Russians will see as some of the abuses that occurred on Yeltsin's watch. And that's unfortunate, because I think the Russian people deserve better.
Is that how history will view him as well? Somebody who did a heroic thing? When you think about it, when you think about a Communist Party member, a boss, turning on the Communist Party, it would have been unthinkable 10 years earlier. I'm guessing he wouldn't have survived it.
Absolutely. Yeltsin was a true hero. I mean, to stand up this way, to stand on the tank when he knew that there were sharpshooters that were within range, to have killed him, but to resist that, to stand up for what he thought was a much better Russia. For that, he deserves enormous credit. But at the same time, offsetting that will be what the Russians will see as the disintegration of that great country as a superpower, as a leader. It may have stood for the wrong kind of values, but the Russians wanted to be thought as a great power country, and Yeltsin undid that for them. So on the one hand, he's a hero. On the other hand, he's a tragic figure for them.
Marshall Goldman, senior scholar in the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University, speaking to us about Boris Yeltsin, Russia's first freely elected president. He died today at 76. Marshall Goldman, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
Well, before we go today, the art of storytelling in 12 minutes or less. We're listening to Stories at the Moth. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. Here in Boston, Mayor Thomas Menino has proposed stripping convicted gun offenders of their right to drive for up to 5 years in the wake of a surge in shootings that's also been seen in other cities. Critics of the idea say that most such offenders have already lost their license for other reasons. Well, meanwhile, families that have lost loved ones to shootings struggle with the lack of arrests and the frequent feeling that they're forgotten by police and prosecutors. Here now is David Boeri, visited one such family in Boston.
If y'all can give me 1 second so I can pull this chicken out.
On Morton Street in Boston, the house is packed, the kitchen is cooking up cornbread, collards, and pig's feet, and the family of Antoine Perkins is celebrating his 21st birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to
you. Everywhere you look, there are photos of Antoine, even on the birthday cake. He's big, over 300 pounds, and baby-faced, he smiles like the laughing Buddha.
Happy birthday to you.
Antoine's year-old son, his 8-year-old brother, his parents and grandparents, his girlfriend, and the rest of his family are all present and accounted for, all except for Antoine himself. He has the most forgivable yet unacceptable excuse in the world for not being here. It's written on the cake.
It's your 21st birthday, and you're not here because you're spending your birthday with Jesus this year.
Almost a year ago, Antoine was shot in the back of the head as he sat on his family's front porch with a friend. Their barking dog woke his parents, Anthony and Audrey, who found him standing up, scared, and struggling to breathe.
And he was like, "Mommy, oh my God, they shot me. I can't believe they shot me. I'm going to die." And I said, "Antoine, if you believe in God, just pray. Just pray."
2 days later, he was Boston's 45th homicide victim of the year.
He was the closest student I've ever had that's been murdered, and it was very hard for me.
His former headmaster, Matt Malone, remembers Antoine's struggles with a learning disability that statistics and expectations say generally doesn't result in a high school diploma.
My role as a high school headmaster, high school principal, was that Antoine was my kid, and I was going to make sure that he had the same right and chance as any other student in the school. And when folks wanted to throw Antoine out, I said, "That's not going to happen."
Malone is a former Marine at 5'3", and toward the 6'3", 300-pound special needs student, he was Semper Fi.
Schools and teachers that do well with kids like Antoine are schools and teachers that understand that not all kids learn the same way at the same time on the same day. And Antoine needed a great deal of structure and support.
Raising Antoine took tough love, two parents and teachers committed to the principle that this kid mattered. Antoine persevered. He was mainstreamed in his senior year, passed the mandatory state exam, and graduated from high school, a triumph that made his death even more of a tragedy.
I could tell he really wanted it. You know what I'm saying? Out of all the kids that Antoine hung around here with, he's the only one that graduated from high school.
That success created distance between Antoine and some gang members in his neighborhood. His mother believes their resentment led them to murder her son.
They do it now as if you were crossing the street. It's nothing to them because no one does go to jail.
Antoine's murder is unsolved. Here in Boston, as in other cities across the country with rising crime rates, most homicides go unsolved. So far this year, only 3 of 17 have been solved in Boston.
We all set? Bow your heads.
Yes.
Antoine's family complains their calls to the police have gone unanswered. And though a victim's advocate from the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office is supposed to make contact with the family of a murder victim within 48 hours to offer services and support, no one contacted the Perkins family for 7 months, as the office acknowledges.
Lord, this is one day that we really wish it never come the way it's coming.
Audrey and Anthony Perkins have far more faith in God than in the police or the district attorney.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Here now is David Boeri in Boston. Stay with us just ahead. Stories in 12 Minutes at the Moth. That's here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Remember when folks would gather around and just tell stories? Bowling Alone author Robert Putnam wrote about the loss of this kind of intimacy. Well, he would be pleased with Stories at the Moth.
My name is O.T., and I'm a retired pickpocket.
It was 5 days before my 10-year high school reunion when my husband told me he thought he might be gay.
And one time I asked him, Dad, what was going on in the cockpit on the way down? And he said all the men were screaming, Captain Brawley, I don't want to die, I don't want to die. And I said, I can understand, Dad. What were you doing? He said, solving the problem.
And then her sister gets up off the bed, runs across the room, and as she enters the bathroom goes, just because she's dying, she gets to do everything and I get nothing! Slam!
Stories at the Moth is a traveling stage and barroom event that flutters, moth-like, from one night spot to the next with new storytellers each time. It started monthly in New York, spread to L.A., it's now on tour. Some of the storytellers are famous, Ethan Hawke or Frank McCourt come to mind. Most aren't. Stories are unscripted, some have adult content, and all are over in 12 minutes. Catherine Burns is the artistic director of The Moth, and she joins us now from the Argo Network in New York City. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
And we're also joined with writer and comedian Jonathan Ames, the self-described Jewish Duke of Windsor and Moth regular. Hi, Jonathan. And I want to start with Catherine because, you know, what's the difference between this and stand-up?
With stand-up, the point is to be funny. I mean, stories can be funny, but mini Moth stories aren't just funny. You know, we tell serious stories. Some of the stories make you laugh. Some of them make you cry. So there's much more of a range. It's not about getting to a joke.
We understand that writer George Green came up with the idea because, what, he observed of New York that there were these, I think I read, 10-second sound bites, but no storytelling.
Yeah. Right, yeah. He grew up on an island off the coast of Georgia where they had no cable, and he and his friends would sit around and tell stories on their porch. And when he moved to New York, you know, he was just like everybody, cocktail party chatter, sound bite this, sound bite that. Nobody, you know, is really taking the time to really slow down and tell old-fashioned stories. And so that's why he founded The Moth, to create a venue for that.
Right. He called it The Moth because when they sat on the porch, the moths would flitter around by the light. And right. So the moth kind of really got in his mind, kind of like Orson Welles with the rosebud and Citizen Kane. So that's right. Why he called this group The Moth.
And I know, Jonathan, you're a regular. And we have a clip here of your story. It's about a depressed Christmas day at a transsexual bar, having just... Well, you take it from there.
Okay, so on this particular day, I had just separated from my 6-year-old son. He was headed down to Florida with my parents to be with his mother on Christmas Day, and I was left all alone in New York, despairing, missing my son, and made the incorrect decision to start drinking. And so kind of a mad Odyssean night sort of took place, began in an Irish bar, ended up in a transsexual bar. And the rest is history in a very pleasant way, though, because ultimately what happened was quite tender and even sort of beautiful.
And I woke up and I was sweating and I was like, oh my God, what have I done? I've relapsed on alcohol and drugs. This is what I did with my beautiful feelings for my son. I've done this. I'm in a flop hotel. I'm in trouble. It was just this feeling, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. Oh my God, I've got to get out of here. And I stood up in bed and I said, I have to go. She woke up. She said, no, baby, come on. I want us to have a nice Christmas. I'm like, no, I have to go. She goes, look, I can't let you leave like this. She said, wait. So she went down the hall and she got a washcloth and some water. And she came back and she started bathing my face. She goes, I can't let you go like this. And she just started bathing my face so kindly and so good to me. And I felt so, she really helped me. And so that's what I'll always remember in that lowest point in my life, that this person was kind to me. So that's my story. Thank you.
Jonathan Ames, you're a regular at The Moth. You've also told stories on The David Letterman Show. What have you seen from people who are real newcomers to this that's knocked you off your seat?
What can happen, and when we perform in New York, we do it sometimes for as many as like 300 to 400 people, and the storytellers will be so wildly vulnerable. We've had storytellers start crying, and I don't want to make it sound like they're exploited, but it's just very human, very real, and very powerful. It's theater that's quite unexpected. You mentioned that the stories are about 12 minutes long, and The Moth, unlike readings or even like a conversation with a dear friend, nobody goes on too long because at the 10 or 12-minute mark, There'll be a musical intrusion, usually a violin player. So the storyteller knows that they have to kind of wrap up. And if they don't wrap up, then the musician will start playing again, and it sort of becomes like a duel, like out of Deliverance, but, you know, much more genteel. Kind of a genteel vaudevillian hook.
We understand story nights are organized around themes from the Seven Deadly Sins to Hollywood horror stories, war stories, of course, politics. Here we have former Clinton White House Press Secretary Joe Lockhart getting up to tell his story. It's called Impeachment Day. Catherine, can you just set this up for us?
The story starts with Joe and his first White House press trip. And he actually gets drunk in Moscow. He stays out all night. He falls asleep and wakes up having missed Air Force One. So he manages to catch up with the president in Ireland, I believe. And so he's asleep in his room when there's a knock at the door, and it's an aide telling him that the president and Bono would like to see him immediately. Bono. But he thinks it's a practical joke.
Okay.
So he tells him to bug off and goes back to sleep.
Yeah, it's Bono and from U2. So let's listen.
Okay.
About 3 minutes later, he came in and said, "Hey, the president's in. He's in with the band U2 with Bono, and they want to talk to you." I said, "Well, if the president wants to see me, he can walk his presidential ass right back to this room and ask me himself." Well, about 60 seconds later, the presidential ass showed up and said, "What is your problem? These guys want to meet you." So I walked into the meeting, and this rock star, Bono, comes up and gives me this big hug and says, "I really want to meet you." And I said, "Well, that's great, Mr. Bono, but why?" And he said, "Anyone who can handle world affairs, you know, Monica Lewinsky and all that, and still has time to stay out all night drinking is my kind of guy."
Catherine, I'm wondering, I know the people who are going to tell the stories are, you know, get worked with. How do they get picked?
There's a lot of ways. I mean, sometimes people come to us through, we have an open mic slam program in New York where anyone can come put their name in the hat, and if they're picked, they have 5 minutes to tell a story. And a lot of people just recommend people to us, like, you know, collection of voicemails that I might get could be someone telling us that they were at a benefit and heard Edward Norton telling a story and that he's brilliant and we have to track him down. And the next message will be someone giving me the cell phone number of the cab driver from their cab ride the night before. He was from Pakistan and brilliant, and we have to track him down, and we follow up on all of them equally.
Catherine Burns is the artistic director of The Moth. Jonathan Ames is a writer, comedian, frequent Moth contributor. Thank you both for telling us what it's all about.
Well, if possible not to intrude, I often end the Moth shows with this sound called the Harry Call.
Oh,
so after all this storytelling and all this articulation, I make this sound, which is this childhood sound that my friends and I would make on the playground when being attacked by more normal children. And it kind of always puts a nice coda. So I'll do one now.
Sure.
For your audience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Here, say that sounds like a Wookiee. We got to hear one more of those, because I'm thinking I might work it into the program on a regular basis. Can I hear the Harry call again?
Yeah. If you sell it as a ringtone, let me know, though. Because,
okay, right.
Okay.
Jonathan and Catherine, both of you, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Stories at the Moth is in Boston tonight. For more on the Moth or the Moth Story Tour, go to our website, here-now.org. I think we might have to end the program with the Harry Call every day. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.